This is Gil Manser, your word-by-word conversations with the writer's host on Northern California Public Media, KRCB-FM. Today, our sound engineer, Anthony Garcia, and I are pleased to welcome the return of best-selling novelist Lisa See with her newest tale of strong women surviving against seemingly impossible odds, The Island of Sea Women. Born in Paris, France, Lisa See has spent many years in Los Angeles as a writer and novelist. Her paternal great-grandfather was Chinese, making her 1/8 Chinese, and this has had a great impact on her life and work. She has written for and led in many cultural events, emphasizing the importance of Los Angeles and Chinatown, including the libretto for the opera based on her On Gold Mountain. She proudly helped to develop the Family Discovery Gallery at the Autry Museum, which depicts 1930s L.A. from the perspective of her father as a 7-year-old boy. Her exhibition, On Gold Mountain, A Chinese-American Experiences, was featured in the Autry Museum of Western Heritage and the Smithsonian. Among her awards and recognitions are the Organization of Chinese-American Women's 2001 Award as National Woman of the Year and the History Makers Award presented by the Chinese-American Museum. Lisa See's web pages share the following. The Island of Sea Women deftly explores the complexities of female friendship and introduces readers to the remarkably strong and spirited female divers of Jeju Island. It's also an eye-opening portrait of a country ravaged by decades of conflict and unrest, and a searing examination of the effects that foreign intervention can have on the evolution of a nation and, of course, individuals. It asks the eternal questions, how do we find forgiveness? Can we find forgiveness? Booklist has called the novel a stupendous multi-generational family saga. See's latest also provides an enthralling cultural anthropology, highlighting the soon-to-be-lost matriarchal henyo phenomenon and an engrossing history of violently tumultuous 20th century Korea. Stupendous and mesmerizing. Well, that kind of, our job is done here.
I sure was happy to when I read that. I've never had the word stupendous used in a review before.
It is a stupendously interesting book. My wife read it first, and I must tell you that we read in bed, and she stopped at one particular point in your novel, which she didn't see coming. You know the part I'm talking about, I assume.
Well, I can guess a couple,
through,
but
half,
okay,
through.
Yes. Page 231,
and
I believe.
She put the book down, and she says, I don't believe this. I've never heard of this.
Mm-hmm.
And I would imagine that I've never heard of this is the reaction to readers all across the country.
Yeah, it has been. And even there are a lot of Korean Americans and people who were born and raised in Korea who have not heard about this incident that happened on Jeju Island. And so, but it is something that was kept a secret by the government, you know, under pain of arrest, jail, death, to you and your family mm-hmm. for 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think there have been some articles about it, and there's naturally the now Human Rights Report that about what went on there.
Yeah.
That's still an ongoing project, investigation.
Yeah.
It's now the longest ongoing investigation in the world for this kind of thing.
Wow. Well, we'll get to that in a
yeah.
bit, but we're going to start the book as you do, and I think this is an interesting way to do this, and I'm going to talk to you and ask why you did it this way, but we start in the present day. An old woman is sitting on a little cushion that's tied to her butt,
mm-hmm.
and she's sorting out the different kinds of
algae and seaweed that wash ashore
overnight, putting them in different baskets,
mm-hmm.
and she's approached by a young woman who has some photographs. And then we start back when this same woman who was an old woman on the beach was 15 years old. And she is going down for the first day to be a, what do they call them, baby diver?
Baby diver,
yes.
Yeah.
And you explain to us what the women of Jeju Island do.
So for hundreds of years, they have been free divers. They take deep breaths. They dive down about as deep as 60 feet. They stay underwater 2 to 3 minutes. They harvest seafood. And so they've been the breadwinners in their families. And their husbands are the ones who stay home, take care of the kids, do the cooking, take care of the house, take care of the elders.
All right. And what do they get? What do they gather when
they're down there? They get abalone, sea urchin, turban shell, octopus, anything that's sort of on rocks, on
that
living
sticks
on,
to the
yeah,
rocks,
that sticks
right.
to the rocks, lives in or on rocks.
And one of the things we get to do is see what happens when they take these back to their houses and create different dishes. Some are more valuable, so those get mm-hmm. sold.
Right.
You don't, something that's a little underweight or a little off color, that's what gets put into the family pot.
Right. And then certain things like algae that are used for, you know, all kinds of different things, you know, today and makeup and cosmetics. During World War II, the Japanese who were in control of this, of South Korea, you know, it was a Japanese colony at that time.
Mm-hmm.
They had the women stop diving for food and only dive for a particular kind of algae because it was used in the making of gunpowder.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, this is part of the history of this region, this island, this southern island in South Korea now. And when you go online and you ask about it, it's become a honeymoon destination.
Oh, it is. It really is considered the Hawaii of Asia. It's so beautiful, for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
But you see all these honeymooners there, and they have big tourist resorts and golf courses and, you know, just like Hawaii. It looks
right.
like Hawaii.
With
but
sandy
it's,
beaches and mm-hmm. sunshine and, yeah, palm trees.
Oh, lots of palm
lots
trees.
Lots of palm trees. But that's not the island that these ladies live in. We really have two people who are, you have Young-suk
mm-hmm.
and Mija, who mm-hmm. is her best friend. They're both approximately the same age, come from different families. So give us a little bit about the background of Young-suk.
So her mother is the chief of the diving collective in her village.
Mm-hmm.
And I think because of that, she has kind of like this positive stamp on her forehead of what her future will look like. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's a very good future. And then Mija, her father was a Japanese collaborator. And now she's an orphan. So she, too, has this kind of stamp on her forehead, only it's not quite so positive.
Right.
And
well, the war is still on at this time.
They're under Japanese
control.
You know, their control. And so I've written about fate and destiny in mm-hmm. other books that I've written, but this time and still am in this one, but also that idea of, you know, free will and free choice and how much can you sort of fight that stamp that's been put on you as a child.
And they have different stamps.
And they have very
as
different stamps.
As the daughter
stamps.
Of a collaborator, she has quite a different stamp.
Mm-hmm.
And she, not only that, she's not from the village.
She's not from the village.
Her grandmother lives in another village close by.
It's actually like the main village of Hado in real life has seven districts to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they live in different districts of this same village.
Right.
And that's because this particular village, even today, has the most henyo on the island. Today, they still have about 300 in just this one village.
They must be older now.
Though, yes, they are older. But they divide up into groups of about 30 so
mm-hmm.
that each collective isn't, you know, too old. You know, if you had 300 people all going out at one time in one
right.
group, it'd be kind of overwhelming.
Right.
So, yeah, you're right that these are older women. They used to retire, let's say, the late 1970s.
Yeah.
In the late 1970s, there were still about 30,000 of these divers, and they would retire at age 55 if they lived that long.
Right.
And today, there are a little under 4,000 of them, and the youngest one is 55. So when I was there, I interviewed women in their 70s, 80s, a couple in their 90s, most of whom were still diving.
Mm-hmm. Still diving.
Still diving.
Well,
they were doing that for fun as well.
They do. That's their entertainment.
It's companionship.
Right.
You know, they don't want to watch TV. They want to get out there and be with their friends. And they do have this real connection to the sea,
mm-hmm.
you know, and a lot of aphorisms that kind of reflect that, like, what's one of them? The sea is better than your mother. The sea is forever.
Except they also have one, every woman who enters the sea
carries a coffin on her back. Yeah.
That'll make you think.
Yep.
And she, of course, they've all grown up with these aphorisms, you
mm-hmm.
know, because they're used frequently, shall
right.
we say. Everybody knows them. All the young women do. There's quite a distinct difference if you're a boy or a girl of what you will do as you grow up.
Mm-hmm.
The girls are really quite focused on joining the collective, as you said, starting out as a baby diver, moving up, you know, over the years as they become more skilled. I don't know how they're measured, but somehow they get better and better, and then they are able to sit in a different part of the boat, as mm-hmm. I recall.
Well, some of it has to do with breath control. Mm-hmm. You know, how if you start out, maybe you can hold your breath 45 seconds or a minute, but if you're working your way up to 3 minutes, that takes a while. But also just the general skills that you need to be able to go down. You know, maybe you can't, on your first dive, get down to 60 feet. It probably right. takes a long time to get there. And to learn, you know, that is deep enough to get the bends. Mm-hmm. And so how you deal with the water in that way, but also just things like how to harvest an abalone, which even today is one of the most, or probably the most valuable thing that a woman can harvest in right now, today. It's about the equivalent of about $30 for a single abalone.
Why don't you read just this little bit here?
Oh, now I have to look for glasses.
Oh, okay. Well, it doesn't matter. we can summarize.
You read it for me.
Oh, I can do that. The sambisori is a special sound like the whistle or a dolphin's call a haino makes as she breaches the surface of the sea and releases the air she's held in her lungs, followed by a deep intake of breath. And that's one of the measures of when you can move up as a diver, that how well you do that, how loud that is, and the fact that you have to speak loudly because everybody's losing their hearing because of the, you know, the pressure under the water. What if you run out of air in the watery depths? Mija asked. Breathing in, breathing out. Every beginning has worries about this, grandmother blurted before my mother could answer. You could be impatient with Mija. Your body will know what to do, mother said reassuringly. And even if it doesn't, I will be there with you. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the things that I thought was really, really interesting was the protectiveness, you know, the mother hen kind of the older divers to mm-hmm. the younger, and the pairing up, you know, the buddy right. system, as we used to call it when mm-hmm. we'd go swimming. And unfortunately for the people who are involved, things don't always work as planned. And there are tales. There's one about an octopus and one with an abalone. And they have long-lasting consequences.
Right.
I'm trying to be very,
right.
you know,
well,
off, not
you know,
give too much away.
One of the things is that the henyo really feels strongly about, in a negative way, is greed. Mm-hmm. And that a henyo cannot be greedy. That this is like the worst thing she can be. And so in at least one of those instances that you mentioned, that really, you know, this terrible accident results from a moment of greed. Mm-hmm. And I want to get that, you know, and I think that's something that they all traditionally have struggled with, is you see something, you want to get it because it's how you make your living.
Right.
And yet you could run out of air, you could cause injury or death to somebody else. So it's you're not in the air world, you're in the watery world, and right. you have to be so careful.
Well, I knew about the danger of an octopus, and of course, you know, getting their tentacles stuck on inside a crevice and mm-hmm. holding on tightly, and them around you and not getting away. But I didn't know the secret to getting an abalone loose from the rocks.
Right.
And this, you carry this special tool, which allows you, theoretically, to be able to do that with mm-hmm. ease. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it doesn't happen that way.
Right. Well, an abalone, you know, when it's just minding its own business, it kind of floats above the rock so that the water can float in and around it. That's how it gets its nutrients.
Right.
And so they do have this special tool that they slip in under the shell and flip it off the rock.
Right.
But let's say there's that abalone, it's minding its own business, and now a diver is coming down, but maybe she casts a shadow over its shell, or maybe the way she's kicking sends water around it in a you know, startling way. And so just as she slips her tool under the shell, it will clamp down and then hold that tool, which is strapped to her wrist,
right.
And she can't get loose.
Okay, well, we've done the setup for both of these events. Mm-hmm. Now we have to send people to the book to find out what happens. So one of the things is there's the – it's called a matriarchal society.
No, matrifocal.
Matrifocal.
Because it isn't an actual matriarchy. Women don't own property.
They don't. That's the interesting thing.
Right.
There's still this old Korean tradition, I guess, of mm-hmm. the men are in the ones who were in charge.
Right.
And, the women do all the work.
The women do all the work. But the men are educated. They get to be what, you know, the phrase is they, I mean, yes, they take care of the babies and all of that, but that they, quote, sit and think under the village tree. I'd like that job myself, you know, but sitting and thinking under the village tree. And so they are, even though they're just, you know, villagers, but they are considered to be more intellectual and that they're thinking these great thoughts.
Right.
About poetry and art and philosophy and, you know, Confucianism and, you know, all of these bigger things. And so, you know, many of these women, they, from a young age, they're working and saving money so that their brothers can be sent to school.
Right.
While they themselves don't get to go
they
to school.
They don't get to go, no. In fact, the opportunity comes up for education at several times to the main character, I guess we'll call her. And she says, no, I can't do that.
Yeah.
I can't do that. I'm not a boy.
Right.
Yeah.
And then when it's for her own children, she's just like, who? No. You know, for her own daughter, she's like, no, they have to come and dive to send their brothers to school. And it's her husband who's like, no, you know, we want them all to be educated.
Right, right. So in a sense, it's a you must take over the family business kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no doubt about that you the women will.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Except no longer in real life.
Right.
In the late 1970s was the first time that girls in South Korea could go to public school. I mean, if you just think about it, that's so recent.
Mm-hmm.
But even the public school required fees. And so these divers who were illiterate themselves, they started saving their money so that they could send their daughters to school. And that's part of why it's dying. I mean, the main reason it's dying out is that the very thing, you know, that made these women good mothers, saving up money to send their daughters to school, is also the very thing that's going to make this culture extinct.
Well, the other thing is, when you think about it, the free diving is a dying art.
Mm-hmm.
You can, you know, snap a scuba, you know, equipment on, or even use a snuba, you know, the air with a hose, and go down and do this. I have a friend who's was a professional sea urchin diver, and that's essentially he was doing exactly the same thing, but he's got a connection, you know, with fresh air coming down to everywhere he goes, and he can stay down for hours.
Mm-hmm.
So, whole different ball game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh well. But part of that is the tradition is you weren't allowed to do that. There were restrictions put on it that were decided, which I found fascinating, by a group of men.
Mm-hmm.
Who got together and decided what could be collected, what couldn't be collected, at what seasons, et cetera, et cetera. Did they have the knowledge
base? That was much later. I mean, that is a more recent phenomenon, again, starting in the late 1970s,
okay.
when the government started having these village fishery associations and would put a man in charge of that.
Right.
Which here you'd had hundreds of years of the women being completely in charge of it. Yeah, so that's part of how it shifted, was just at the same time girls were getting an education, the men were stepping in and taking over a little bit.
Right. Besides, you've got all these new tourists coming in who need somebody to take care of them.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And apparently being on the island, going to the mainland was a big, big deal. And one of the things that really surprised me, I went, what? Because you open up one of the chapters and all of a sudden the women are diving in Russia. In very, very cold water, moving the ice out of the way as they go in the morning from the boat. And
in little cotton homemade outfits.
Yeah. Yeah.
No wetsuits, nothing like that.
No wetsuits. Well, they were wet because they went in the ocean, but they were just basically like a T-shirt kind of thing. Yeah.
This is one of the things that in the past anyway – that this group of women had the greatest ability of any human group on Earth to withstand cold water. And I found all of these amazing studies. I mean, just really amazing studies of scientific studies looking at what it was about these women that could, you know, that allowed them to do this. Was it genetic? Was it some type of an adaptation? And I really went down the rabbit hole on that one. And so there is a part in the novel where, guess what, some scientists arrive.
The doctors in white coats arrive
they
with ties.
Because to me it was so fascinating what they found and how they did their work and sort of what happened in these during the course of these different studies, particularly in the late 1960s and 70s, that I was just so kind of wowed by it that I had to include it.
You include it in the end,
yep,
as well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you have it in the narrative, but you have the actual facts and figures.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. It's fascinating. Really astounding, the differences that these women could, you know, the really cold
really
conditions.
Cold. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember the old Houdini movie where he climbs in a bathtub of ice before he jumps off into the river to get used to it. And I was thinking, well, these ladies have been doing it since they were babies.
Yeah, practically.
Yeah. When you were doing this, what did you find to be the most surprising? You kind of made a composite for your characters, would you say, from real people that you met or not?
Yeah, some from real. What I would say is not necessarily a composite, but I did interview a lot of women there. And, for example, I did interview a woman whose father was a Japanese collaborator.
Mm-hmm.
And there are details from her life. It's not her life story by any stretch, but certain things like the first time she saw electricity and what she saw, well, and what she felt when she saw it,
mm-hmm.
and that somehow she'd been magically transported to Japan because only the Japanese could create something so miraculous.
Right.
And those were things that she had talked about, you know, that she was had sugar. And nobody else her age had had sugar. So she had these bits of privilege that no one else that I interviewed did. And so because of that, she had these little details that I was able to use, although her own life in real life has nothing to do with what happens to the character in this book. And then the same with some of the other ones where they're just little details that people will tell me that I'll think, ooh, you know, I've got to use that. You know, got it. This is a really good one. I've got to use that. And that's because, you know, real life is stranger than fiction and more amazing than fiction. And so wherever I can use those real details of things that people share with me, then I will, because it helps to create a character, but it also makes it so unique to that place and that time.
Before we started being on air this morning, I talked with you about how different the voice is in this book than many of your others. And you said that was a conscious, very conscious decision because it's a different kind of story. Do you want to share a bit about that? Or is that your big secret as a writer?
I don't know that it's certainly not a big secret. There was a woman at one of the first events that I gave, and she had an advanced reader's copy, and she raised her hand. She said, you know, she thought that this was my most mature book. And I think that that's really true. I think I've kind of gotten to a point in my own life where I may see things differently and have, more life experience myself and have a different way of looking back over the course of my own life and certain kinds of relationships that I've had. And I really feel like I brought that to Young Suk. She's older than I am when the book starts, but I do think that the way she looks back at her life is kind, you know, it's not a reflection of how I look at mine, but I brought some of what I feel like where I am to her. And then the way she's struggling with forgiveness, this idea of forgiveness. And we haven't talked about the 4-3 incident yet, but
no,
you know, I'm sure we will. But you know, to me, one thing that's interesting when you write something is how you can have a plot in mind. You know the things that are going to happen. That there, you know, people are going to start as baby divers, and then there might be an encounter with an octopus, and there's, you know, they're going to go to Vladivostok, and they're going to get married, and they're going to have kids, and you know, the things that just happen in the course of a novel. But your subconscious is also really working in ways that I think sometimes writers don't fully understand. And so even though I knew that there was going to be this theme of forgiveness having to do with the 4-3 incident, in fact, it's right there from the very first chapter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with the results of the encounter with the octopus and what that means to Chunja, that character, and how that kind of plays out throughout the novel, and what happens to Yong-suk's mother, and just different, and the Kang sisters, that all of them are, in a way, do struggle with forgiveness. And so in my mind, when I started out, I knew I was going to have this sort of larger story of forgiveness that has to do with this big historic moment. But actually, forgiveness is something that happens, you know, one-on-one, between families, between neighbors, between cultures, between societies, between countries. And so that was the part, I think, that really surprised me and is the part where I think that also comes out of where I am, like, now that I'm a grown up, you know, like, now that I'm more mature.
Sits up in your chair and says that, right.
You know, that I just felt like that came through in a way that was deeper than some of, I'm not criticizing my previous books, but sort of a deeper place for me. Does that make any sense?
It does. And the interesting thing, we've been watching Time Team, which is a British show where they go and do excavations all over, you know, Britain and other places too, and go down and discover the how people lived, mm-hmm. you know, in the roundhouses during the Iron Age and then, you know, the Roman times and in the Victorian times, et cetera, et cetera. And that's a lot of what this book is about, is how people in a really quite different culture than our own, not just time-wise. I mean, it's an ancient culture. You could see this happening in the 1600s, mm-hmm. different, you know, players in different uniforms, but the same kinds of things going on. Because the guilt, as you mentioned, is that, and the forgiveness is that you have for your neighbors.
Right.
Or your family.
Right.
And then it expands out, you know, mm-hmm. as other people become involved and, you know, world events start mm-hmm. intruding. But that's true when you're living with 300 people, you know, in a village somewhere in mud huts, or right. in this case, stone huts. Forever.
Mm-hmm.
Because things are going to happen. Bad things are going to happen.
Right.
Or really good things are going to happen, and somebody's going to be left out. And that's what happens here.
Mm-hmm.
You are listening to Word by Word, Conversations with Writers on Northern California Public Media, KRBC.
We had someone do that earlier, too.
I don't know. All right. You are listening to Word by Word, Conversations with Writers on Northern California Public Media, KRCB-FM. Today, we are pleased to welcome the return of best-selling novelist Lisa See with her newest tale of strong women surviving against seemingly impossible odds. In this case, readers are introduced to the remarkably strong and spirited female divers of South Korea's Jeju Island in The Island of Sea Women. So tell me why you chose to start in the present day with your opening.
So when I was there, I was interviewing a lot of very active divers.
Right.
So we'll call them younger divers, sort of 55 to 70, 75. But there is this group, I'd say in their 80s, mostly in their 80s and older, who are maybe semi-retired. Yes, they'll dive sort of offshore, but they're not diving in the deep sea.
Mm-hmm.
But the main thing they do is they gather and sort seaweed on the beach. And so this, you know, I had a kind of captive group of people that
right,
I could just walk
right.
from person to person and talk to.
Did you with a translator?
I had a translator.
Because it's a different dialect.
It's a actually completely different language than standard Korean. And so I had three different translators on this trip for three different types of interviews, actually. But the person I had with me for those beach interviews, it was a young woman about 20 who was a university student.
Mm.
And she was so great. I'm just going to jump to tell you this funny little story, and then I'll come back and answer your question. There always came a moment when we would be talking to one of these older women where the woman would say, "Oh, could you hold your cell phone by my ear? You know, I need to call my son, my nephew, my grandson. You're so pretty, and he's looking for a wife." And that happened so many times that I used that in that very
right.
opening scene.
Right.
And I, you know, have pictures of it on my website. I just so loved that. But anyway, the thing about walking and doing, while I interviewed a lot of people when I was there, this talking to these women on the beach was, for me, the most fun. And also the kind of most interactive, because if you're talking to someone on the floor of their house, you know, you're very closed in. It's very private. Mm-hmm. But here you're on an active beach, and there are these tourists wandering around on this, you know, on the street up above you, and they're taking pictures, and you know, these women are kind of like tourist sites. You know, the people want to take their pictures, want to watch them, want to come and talk to them. And so I just thought about, you know, what that would be like to have someone like me, total stranger, come up and say, oh, can I just talk to you for a few minutes and take your picture and, you know, ask you about your entire life and some of these really horrible things that have happened on this village. It's an odd thing to do. Mm-hmm. And so I really just took that experience and, you know, also with the young woman and the cell phone, and I just felt like this was a way to have it in the present. Mm-hmm. Although it's really not, it's 2008.
Well, okay.
But also that year 2008 is the opening of what is now called the Peace Park,
the memorial.
Yeah, and so, you know, that was a great year to set it, but also a neat place to set it, and a way that this old woman would be kind of looking around and being aware of all these people staring at her. And then this family comes up and they've got these photographs and they want to ask her questions. And she's like, no, don't do it.
Well,
but it sets her back in time.
It does. I could see that it would, especially when you were, for 50 years, you weren't to talk about it.
Right.
You know, it was the big secret that you were under threat, some of, at one time, of death if you did.
Yeah.
It was considered to be... what's the word I want? Basically, like treasonous.
Treason.
Yeah. So counter something or other. Counter something. Some word.
It's just you weren't allowed to do it.
You weren't allowed to do it, and there were
severe
penalties. Yes. Yeah.
There was one man, I can't remember his name right now, who did write a short story called Aunt Suni about what happened on the island. Mm. And he was arrested and tortured and was in jail for quite a long time. By the Korean government. And so that was actually the only story that was out there for the longest time.
Right.
And, of course, everybody else who saw what happened to him was like, ugh, you know, I'm not going down that road.
I'm not going to go to that. I had a real interesting time when I was reading. I had to go back and read. Should we jump to the incident?
Sure.
Okay. You set it up. You know what you're talking about then. Give us a little bit about the week before.
All right. So World War II is over. The United States, Great Britain, Russia decide to divide Korea into two without asking the Koreans, of course. We, the United States, said we have this really wonderful thing. We're going to come and bring you democracy.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have a great record doing that, but Mm-mm. we're still very enthusiastic. And there was some small print in there. You know, we want you to have your own free elections. We want you to choose. And this would have been their first free elections ever. And ever.
With quotations around free. Yes.
But what they were intended to be.
Right.
But the small print was we chose the one candidate. He did win, and he did become a brutal dictator. Oh, yeah. And he became a brutal – oh, yeah. He did? Yeah.
Only won on the ballot?
He won, and he became a brutal dictator. But in the months, weeks leading up to the election, people on the mainland, people on this island started to demonstrate. You know, we want to have our own free elections. Let us put up our own candidates.
Mm-hmm.
And on this island, things started to escalate. And it was really little stuff at first. It was like somebody threw a rock through a window and now three people would be arrested.
Right.
And then somebody, you know, blew up a bridge. Well, that was a big, you know.
Well,
but it's like one step after another.
Explain who are the people in uniform on the island.
Well, they're police. There's also a group that forms. It's the 9th Regiment Battalion. That is made up, and another group, the Young Men's Southwest Young Men's Youth Association, which was made up of people, young men who had escaped out of North Korea, and they were vehemently anti-communist, and saw, you know,
they had
the
many
threat
of them had been trained by the Americans.
And they were, anyway, vehemently anti-communist. This is, you know, right at the beginning of the Cold War. And there were people, you know, around the world at that time who were sort of embracing aspects of communism. I wouldn't say that, you know, either on the mainland or on the island they were particularly communist, but they were, we'll say, more liberal.
Well, we'll call them socialists, the group that goes, you know, fishing as a collective, right?
That goes fishing as a collective. And so, anyway, things started to escalate until on 4-3, April 3rd, 1948. It's the beginning of what will become an eight-year massacre of the people of this island. And it's estimated between 30 and 80,000 people were killed. 80,000 became refugees, 40,000 fled to Japan, and 70% of all of the villages were destroyed. So
now, this is an island mostly that is based on the seashore.
On the seashore.
And there huge mountains.
Right.
Because
it's
volcanic.
Yeah. Right. And there were a lot of people who lived in that what they call the mid-mountain area, farmers, people who raised horses. And all of the – and the rule was you had to live within 5 kilometers – be within 5 kilometers of the water. They called it the Ring of Fire. And if you were caught on the other side of that – and this is an island that's 40 times the size of Manhattan – so if you just think you only have that 5 kilometers from the shore, if you were caught on the wrong side, you'd be shot on the on sight.
And they were.
And they were. But entire villages were burned, everybody killed. And so not only did they have this 8 years of death and destruction, then for the next 50 years they had to keep it a secret. And, but now this island is – looked at internationally as the island of peace. They have an international peace conference every year, and that, you know, the way they did it was through this idea of forgiveness. And so
is wait till everybody aged out.
Not completely.
Everybody who was there is 80 and above, it kind of makes it.
Well, it makes it a little easier, but actually. There have been a lot of studies about not just what happened on this island, but just in general when you have something that's that traumatic, that the trauma of it gets passed down through the generations.
Like Rwanda is
doing. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So to the second and even the third generation. And so, you know, with this island in particular, they have said that it's an island of people living with post-traumatic stress syndrome because it really was pervasive. And it's because that secrecy, you know, the secrecy only, you know, lasted till basically 2008. So that's not that long ago.
No.
And the penalties were so great. So even if you weren't personally affected or didn't see anything during the massacre years, that doesn't mean you weren't affected by this unbelievable secret and the threat of what would happen if anybody mentioned it. Plus, guilt by association. So if you had somebody in your family who'd been arrested, who'd been killed, even if it was an innocent bystander, you would suffer guilt by association, which meant you might not, you know, you might get accepted to college, but you wouldn't be allowed to go. You might get a job on the mainland, but you wouldn't be allowed to go. You wouldn't get the permit to go.
Right. And it's interesting when you come to the younger generation and their opportunities to go to do that, to go to college, to go to the United States,
right,
et cetera, that there are strings being pulled, not $500,000 being paid, you understand, because that's a hold. It has to be Hollywood to be able to do that. But debts repaid that were, you know, generational, right?
Right.
Right. It's a fascinating book, really fascinating. What's the word that I used earlier in the day? Extraordinary?
Stupendous.
Stupendous. Let's use that one.
Yeah.
It is a stupendously rich book. Because they're, you can read it as a novel, you know, about these young girls growing up and what happens to them.
And friendship.
And friendship and, you know, getting married and finding out that one husband is a lot better than the other one.
That happens sometimes.
It does, doesn't it? About that one mother-in-law is a lot better than another one?
That happens sometimes.
and it's that universality of it. The fact that they're going and doing what they're doing. And then later on, you can see that they'll be going to the, you know, the modern generation. They're going to go to cell phones together or something, or work for the hotels that have, you know, sprung up everywhere. But the same thing, the women are the ones who are the money makers still, right?
Mm-hmm.
And keep the
make well, sure. Well, now it's really shifting back or towards sort of those more traditional gender roles as the henyo die out and that tradition dies out. You have more, you know, yes, maybe both husband and wife work, but the woman is still responsible for the house and the family and the children and the cooking, sort of the traditional way.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people who've moved from the mainland onto the island because there's, you know, a lot of business opportunities mm-hmm. of various sorts. So you do see this sort of shift in the overall culture to away from being a matrifocal culture.
To what they see on TV?
To what we all see on TV and is pretty standard around the world.
Anyway, so you can read it as a novel. Then I'm going to continue on. You can read it as an anthropological study. I could see this being a very interesting book for, you know, some university classes to look at other cultures. You don't have to just read Margaret Mead. You can mm-hmm. go find out about this particular island culture in this particular time. I think the fact that it's so, you know, it's of our era, you know, this World War II had being over. I was born just after it ended. You're 10 years younger. So you lived in, you know, we've lived through that time of being aware of mm-hmm. of what happened. And then the Korean War, which was a strange war because it wasn't ever really declared as a war. It was a UN action and people still don't know what to do with it. I was talking with somebody recently from the, you know, veterans VFW, and they said, you know, the people from Korea and the people from Vietnam, they never felt that they fit in because mm-hmm. we didn't know what that was.
Right.
Yeah, so in this era. Now, there is a culpability with the Americans? They were certainly there when all these atrocities were going on.
So the American military provided surveillance airplanes that were looking for people in the mountains. We provided the tents for refugees. So we would send out soldiers in jeeps to go out into that mid-mountain area. And they did come across some of these things as they were happening,
mm-hmm.
But really did nothing to stop it. So I think the word is complicit.
Mm-hmm.
And
I think that's a perfect word.
Yeah. And we have never – our government has never really acknowledged fully what we did or didn't do. However, in that big report, it's 755 pages at this point, that they did gain access to military archives and U.S. government archives, as well as interviewing a lot of the military personnel who were there. So there is a pretty clear picture of what the United States did and did not do.
Right. With their selected, hand-picked person as president of Korea at the time.
Right.
Anyway, well, so what was your favorite part to write? Do you have a favorite part?
You know, I have to say that I really loved the underwater stuff.
Yeah, it is cool.
I loved it. And there are certain aspects of it. Like even the really cold water, when they're diving off of Vladivostok,
mm-hmm.
that just to be in that other world, but to be in this really, really cold environment, I don't know how they did it. It's amazing. It's also, you know, so dangerous, just the work itself. But I did, and you're right that they did have that saying, every woman who goes into the sea carries a coffin on her back. But they also had this they knew it was dangerous, but also this sense of protection and like being enveloped by the sea.
Mm-hmm.
And every single woman that I talked to, first they'd say how much they loved diving when they were pregnant, because it gave them this sense of buoyancy.
Mm-hmm.
The cold water took away all their aches and pains.
Mm-hmm.
But that every single one just wished for one thing, to have her baby in the field. And in the field meant in the water while you were diving.
Right.
And if you couldn't do that, then to, you know, get on the boat for the last hour, have your baby on the boat, and then be back in the water 2 days later. And that I just loved that connection to this – you know, the sea, it's really big.
Well, our
it's
blood
big
is essentially and, seawater.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So just the sense that they had of it and the appreciation of the power, but also that kind – it's not that they were fighting against the power of it, but how they would kind of connect into the power of the sea.
They were aware of it.
They're aware of it,
yeah.
Being always aware of that environment and the dangers of it, but also the beauty and the womb like nature of it.
Right. Well, the other thing that I thought was fascinating is the shamanism,
mm-hmm.
with the female shamans,
mm-hmm.
who I guess was outlawed.
They were outlawed every other year. Whoever was in power outlawed them.
That's right. And the relationship they would have, you know, where babies would be born, marriages would be done, and the shaman, for your particular group, because I guess every group had their own,
mm-hmm.
would come and do the rituals of old, usually involving, you know, offerings and food and drink and giving something to the sea and taking something back from the sea. That's just a fascinating part of the book as well,
mm-hmm.
because you've created a really interesting character in your main, what we call her, shamaness.
Yeah. So I did get to interview the grand shaman of the island, who mm-hmm. who's a man,
mm-hmm.
but I also met the top woman shaman, whose job it is to go from village to village around the shore,
mm-hmm.
to do these traditions and ceremonies for the henyo.
Right.
And she was just fantastic. She was such an amazing, he was amazing, but she was really an amazing person. And she talked about, how you bring a soul back from the sea.
Mm-hmm.
You know, somebody who's been lost at sea and this
and
sense
the two
of
kinds
soul.
Of lost at
yeah,
sea.
So people yeah. whose bodies are found,
right.
those whose bodies aren't, that she's a conduit between the living and the dead. And, you know, turns out the dead can hold a grudge. They can be mad. They can be lonely. They may want to tell you they love you. And
mm-hmm.
then on this side, we can hold a grudge. We can be mad. You know, all
right.
of those things.
Right.
And that she sees herself as this kind of conduit. Between the living and the dead.
Mm-hmm.
And the way she talked about it, and also this idea of eye sensitivity, of how you would look at a group of people that you're doing a ceremony with and try to, like, read the crowd.
Right.
And I just – she was so inspiring to me, really inspiring and just wonderful.
So
and yet she just – you know, we were just in her house.
Mm-hmm.
She had a daughter. You know, and her grandma, her mother was there, and, you know, it's just like a regular person.
Is this her job?
This is
her job.
But it's also a calling.
So how does she live? Is she like a minister in a church? Or?
Well, it's they don't.
Not
she
a psychotherapist.
She does do these big ceremonies in big temples.
Mm-hmm.
Certain ones that are very unique to the henyo that come once or twice a year, but also just going to individual villages if there's, you know, again, somebody who's been lost at sea, somebody who's ill,
mm-hmm.
some, you know, all of those kinds of things where I guess you would call on a minister to come
mm-hmm.
and help out.
Right. Well, that was another fascinating part. Obviously, your talk with this these shamans impacted how you wrote about them, because they're very strong characters.
Yeah, and both of them had personally suffered from soul loss. This is something quite common with shamans. Some shamans are born into it. So the Grand Shaman, he was a fourth generation.
Mm-hmm.
But in the tradition, yes, there are those who sort of follow along, but almost all of them have a moment in their young lives of soul loss where either they almost die or they've been traumatized in some way, and that they have suffered this sense of, you know, having gone through something so traumatic or an illness that's so traumatic that their soul has kind of left a little bit, and that, you know, how you bring it back in. And so that's another thing that they work on, is how to help people get their soul back where it's supposed to be. And I think his father had been killed during the 4-3 incident. Hers for sure had been.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had.
So these are older people.
Both. Yeah, although she didn't strike me. I mean, 1948, maybe she was still very young. I don't know.
Yeah.
And it could have been anywhere in that 8 years. Right.
Right,
so it could have been as late as whatever. My math is not
54.
Mm-hmm. 54. So, so they were really interesting, and all the tools of their trade, you know, these knives to slash through negativity and gongs and cymbals and
all these
tassels.
Accoutrements that were outlawed.
Yeah, yes. That would be outlawed. And then the Grand Shaman told me, because he was older, how he would improvise instruments. And, mm-hmm. you know, he'd go out and, you know, they took away his drum, so he'd go find a tree trunk and use that, or used cooking utensils to make, improvise cymbals and things like that.
Right. Which, surprise, surprise, is in the book.
Yes, another one of those details.
One of those details.
I didn't just make it up.
That just fleshes it out. So let's talk about your next activity after you get your, get rid of your cough, I mean.
Yes, so I do think about my books for a really long time before mm-hmm. I start to write them. The last one, The Tea Girl of Hummingbird Lane, I thought about for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
This one was 8 years before I started it.
Let's go back 8 years. What prompted it?
I was sitting in a doctor's office
uh-huh.
waiting to be called in. And you know how you're sitting and waiting and waiting. And I was flipping through some magazines. And I came across just one tiny paragraph and one really small photo of these diving women. And I ripped it out of the magazine and took it home.
Hmm.
Yep, I'm the person when you're in the doctor's office and there's a page
missing.
That's
yes.
I'm the one who did
you
it.
You did it.
And I knew even then that one day I would have to write about them. But I had another book to finish and another two to write, and until finally I knew that this was the time. But over the course of that 8 years, any time I would see something, I would, I do feel like you kind of put up your antenna a little bit. And so, or it's just the universe working in mysterious ways where things start to kind of come in around you.
Mm-hmm.
So one of them, I mean, how I even came across this, but it's, about 6 years ago, an article from 1967. So how it passed through my field of vision from Scientific American
mm-hmm.
about this question of, how do these women stand the cold?
Is right.
is it genetic? Is it an adaptation? And that just, anytime I had a little free time, I'd go and look at one of these studies just because
right.
it was fascinating to me. So that was it. It was just this something that I saw that I knew that I wanted to write about. This last summer, I decided I was going to take the summer off. I told myself I hadn't taken that much time off in, I think I said something like 12 years. But when I actually thought about it, it wasn't since I was 12. Because I've always had a summer job from the time I was 12.
Oh, my.
And I took the summer off.
So what did you do?
I cleaned out my closets.
Oh. Something you don't ever do because you're too busy, right?
Yep.
Yep. Spring
cleaning. I got rid of a lot of stuff.
Oh, good.
I got rid of a lot. And
that's
I went for
the
walks.
Japanese book came
that
out
was
telling you how
I
to
did
do
it all
it.
On my yeah, own, on yeah. Own. And I probably could take off another 5 layers but to meet her standards. But I got rid of a lot of things. But one of the things I did was I thought my publisher had said, we want to buy the next 2 books. We don't care what they are. Just
well,
do whatever
nice.
You want. It's wonderful. But I said, well, you know, because I worry. I said, I just want to know what I'm going to write first. I'm thrilled, but let's both agree that we like the next idea. And so they were like, fine, but whatever you want to do, here's the contract. I was like, yeah, before I sign the contract, I just want us to be on the same page. Because right. I'm neurotic. Anyway, so I went through all of my files and all the little places where I keep these ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And once I pulled them all together, I had 29 different ideas.
29 different ideas. So you could do 29 books. Maybe they could pay for all
and
of those.
And some
at once.
Of them truly were something that I had just ripped out of a magazine
right.
or newspaper. And some of them I had collected maybe, well, they can't see what I'm doing, like 8 to 10 inches of material already.
Yeah.
You know, dissertations,
yeah.
books, magazine articles, journals. So everything in between. So I thought, well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to write up the next 5, the top 5. By the time I'd written 4 of them, and each one was about 7 pages.
Yeah, this is your synopsis, essentially.
Yeah, like just a little, you know, just like this. Yeah. And I was like, I'm going to do these 5,
proposal.
And we'll see what the publisher thinks. And these are the 5 I like. By the time I'd done 4 of them, I was like, 3 of them, ugh. No, I'm done. I didn't want to write anymore. But then I finished the last one. So I had 2. And I showed them to my husband. I was ready to send them off. And he was like, oh, Lisa, you know which one you want to do. You don't need to ask them. You know, let them pick. You know the one. And so we won't talk about the second runner-up because that will probably be the next book after the next one.
Okay.
But so this is something I've been thinking about for 26 years. When my grandmother died 26 years ago, I found in her shed a diary that had been written by her mother. And so my great-grandmother Jessie was born on a homestead in South Dakota, came out to Washington State, got pregnant when she was 16, married, and then she and her husband had a very difficult, tumultuous life. They were very poor, and they were itinerant workers who worked from Alaska down to the Mexican border.
Wow.
And so to me, kind of thematically, what this is about is this final push west and then what happens when you hit that Pacific Ocean and where do you go? You know, what people have been coming, and then bam, there you are.
Go west, young man and woman, but there it is.
And then there you can't go any further. And then also it's this time where that kind of old life, all of a sudden you have industrialization, which happens so fast and transforms people's lives so fast. So I'm just going to be telling this story. You know, to me, it's thematically just right in the realm of all of these other books of telling an aspect of history, but through the eyes of a woman, in this case, a poor white woman, in this final moment of the pioneering West.
Mm-hmm. You have been listening to Word by Word Conversations with Writers on Northern California Public Media, KRCB-FM. Today we are pleased to welcome the return of the best-selling novelist Lisa See with her newest tale of strong women surviving against seemingly impossible odds, including the transformation of herself as she created the Island of Sea Women. We appreciate you being here today. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
We invite you to our next Word by Word broadcast from 4 to 5 on Sunday, May 12th, and available as an NPR podcast the next day. Our sound engineer for today's show is Anthony Garcia, and I'm your host, Gil Manser, and we've enjoyed so much having Lisa See here with us today.